This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Thank you all for coming here to listen to us as speakers. Sometimes when you think you become a thinker, you can think too much. And you wonder where your thinking and reality ends and begins. Now, the title is something like "I'm a Late Modernist" or "Late Modernist," I pondered. And I'm an outsider in many ways. First of all, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional landowners who were here before. And I think it's a gesture that people should always remember to make. Remember, once upon a time we talk about modernism and history. Once upon a time we would open such an event as this as toasting the Queen. It has another meaning now, of course. People still toast a Queen somewhere. So to acknowledge that by making that statement is a giant modernist statement. Now, I normally start this by, yes, I am a boundary rider, so to speak, if there is such a thing. I am on the outside of many things. I begin my opening remarks normally by saying my 4A disclaimer. I'm not an anthropologist or archaeologist. I'm not an artist. I don't claim to be an artist. I'm not an academic, but I am an Aboriginal person. And although Emily is not from my country, and I'm not from hers, and this isn't my country here either, there are some observations I can make. Now, we had the statement, modernism is the art of modernity. Aboriginal art is the art made by Aboriginal people. And ice cream, I think, tastes like ice cream. We're sometimes struggling with Europeans in this country. Every society has its own logic and its own form of expression. The problem is that Eurocentric views seem to think that European logic fits with everything else. The filmmaker Wim Wenders made this statement about his most famous film he ever made was a thing called Wings of Desire, The Skies Over Berlin, which is such a loaded German historical spiritual statement about angels, but about German history. It's not funny, it's so self-evident. He said that you cannot place another story on a place. Every place has its own inherent story, historically and spiritually. He bemoaned the fact that the Hollywood machine, which is a very variant bastard version of Eurocentricism, takes stories and places them where they need or where they think. So, in fact, his script for Wings of Desire was purchased, the copyright to that, by Hollywood, and eventually plonked into Los Angeles, City of Angels. Therefore, this film has about angels. On a periphery level, it's about angels, so we'll stick it into Los Angeles. Now, Wim Wenders had already made a film about Los Angeles, about the drug culture in Los Angeles, the drug gangs and the extreme violence within America to do with the prevalence of numbers of guns and the prevalence of drugs of all kinds, where half the population has a very funny view of reality. He said that was the story of Los Angeles. His story had nothing to do with it. Now, the story of Aboriginal art in this country is a Robinson Crusoe type of story. It's the story of a white Eurocentric European male who's shipwrecked on a tropical island in the Pacific. He believes, or he would like to believe, in that Eurocentric tone, that the island is unoccupied physically, socially, and spiritually unoccupied. And then one day, in his travels on that island, he sees a mark. If you know the story, in the story, a footprint. He sees a sign in academic terms, and that sign that tells him the place is occupied, he's not alone, is Aboriginal art. And then he meets the person and tries to interact with that person, but the first thing he does is he names that person. And in naming that person, he appropriates that person, he dominates that person and colonises them. And a great moment, a great historical, social and intellectual moment is missed and cast into the background of history. Now, I only met Emily once. I've never been to Utopia. Are most of you have been to Utopia at all? Don't be shy. It's all right. I'm not Richard Bell. I won't bite your head off. Many people have been to Utopia, most probably metaphorically as well as physically. But it's the irony of such a place being called a utopia surely shouldn't be missed. Now, I've never been there. I was mainly involved in my career in the art world as an art advisor and a curator of art from Northern Australia, from the bark painting tradition of Arnhem Land. And just as much, I suppose, involved in what's called urban Aboriginal art, which is the art of the southeast, or seen to be. Now, in my statement about Aboriginal art is art made by Aboriginals, what's inherent in that statement is that all that art, all Aboriginal art, is in fact contemporary art. And I mean by contemporary not in a Western sense of descriptions going through modernism, postmodernism, etc. In fact, the debate seems to be one step behind the reality all the time. Now, why don't we talk about Aboriginal art as if you're going to talk about it as postmodernism, surely, not modernism? I look at all Aboriginal art as being contemporary art, and that is made within most probably the last 50 years. It's not surprising, I think, that most of the Aboriginal art in collections in Australia and around the world, in collections of all kinds, when you talk about in art terms, that is, not documents, etc., 90% of that artwork was collected post-World War II. Now, that makes it very contemporary. And most of that art, in fact, was made as a response, as a form of communication back to the empire, to people trying to colonise Aboriginal people. It's a response to what's happening within Australia. Now, so trying to put Western Desert art, as Emily fits into a category on one way, is really interesting. Aboriginal art was taken into the academy, into the cathedral of Western art in Australia in the post-World War II period, in the 50s, 60s and so on. Now, in that time, no one quite knew how it really fitted in. Obviously, as we've said before, people have been saying since we opened this morning, Emily wasn't exactly, didn't do her PhD in French Impressionism or American Abstraction. None of the artists I did, I worked with, had read an art book in a Western sense. All these things are pretty self-evident. We puzzle with them. So what we do is we, that's collectively Aboriginal people and non-Aboriginal Australians, trying to work out how does Aboriginal art fit into a Western history and how does it fit into our history, Australia, Australian history. As was just said at the tail end of the last talk and the discussion, and it's happened in Japan and other places. In Japan, you can have Japanese minimalist. There's a period where Japanese minimalism was taken on. There's a period of Japanese surrealist and so on. And in Australia in the 50s, you have Australian abstractionist and so on, surrealist and so on. Now, Aboriginal art comes from somewhere else, and as Ian just said quite correctly, it doesn't come from a Western art history. Therefore, the development of it is something pretty unique. It's pretty unique in the sense that, yes, it does have a history of 30,000 years of art practice. Even in a visual art field, it's 30,000 years of development. People were playing around with mark making. People were playing around with colours and creating visual art. Then you have the catastrophe, as it's called, of the coming of the Europeans, the collision that happens between two cultures. And in that, Aboriginal people react and interact by using Western art materials. The interaction should be seen as a material thing, not as an intellectual process. Aboriginal people are using Western materials, but trying to tell an Aboriginal statement or expression. And that is the most one of the most important points. Aboriginal artists aren't trying to do abstract expressionism, to create minimalism or any of those things. Unlike, as I said, Australian artists who took on the influence of minimalism and the Japanese and lots of other countries where they were touched by what was happening in supposedly the centre of the known universe. Now, despite Aboriginal people being in interaction with Western societies since for over 200 years in Australia, they never saw the centre, they never saw Europe as the centre of the known universe. Emily's centre of the known universe is where she was born and lived. She might have came to Canberra, in fact that's why I met her. She was getting her Keating Fellowship, and I met her in Parliament House. There's a very quiet, seemingly warm old woman that looked up and smiled and shook hands with people and most probably wondered what the hell was going on. No one really spoke to her very much, and vice versa. So that's sort of where I'm coming from. My experience of Emily is as of another Aboriginal person trying to cope with the interaction with Western society, with white Australian society. Trying to do the right thing, trying to be good-mannered, trying to explain herself in ways that are not offensive, etc. Try to be what's called a sophisticated person, as she was. People told me many things. There are anthropologists who worked with Emily, who's there's myths about she didn't talk very much, etc. There's an anthropologist friend of mine who spent a day with Emily and another group of women, and said Emily talked to her for hours. Of course, she couldn't understand anything Emily said, and most probably that's a metaphor for the whole story we're trying to struggle with today. Emily spoke for about 3 hours to this woman who knew many Aboriginal languages, but she couldn't understand anything she said. So I saw this person and people raved about her. Sorry, my bad colloquialisms. People thought that her work was so strong, so inventive and so intellectual, and yet not really knowing it. So in a way, most probably today, it's like the four blind men and the elephant, really, about trying to make sense of things. There are very few of us here who can speak a Matjara. Can anyone speak a Matjara? Or whatever Peter Garrett called it last night, Amadiriya or something. So, in fact, when you can't even say what it is, it's interesting where the communication begins. There seems to be some form of virus going through the country at the moment, and it's called public speaking consultants who are telling people how to pronounce words. So even the ABC is saying stupid things like Toowoomba and Banila instead of Ballina, and making even worse abominations of attempts with artist names from the centre, as we got an earful last night. Now, my own thing with Emily was it was beautiful work. I really appreciated the very basic mark making that she was doing. You had this amazing person, and I used to sell Aboriginal art before. I'll confess to that. I wasn't quite a carpetbagger. I was an Aboriginal version of that, so it's most probably a linoleum bagger, so to speak. And I never used these terms. It was quite easy, quite interesting to hear people break into a vernacular, colloquial vernacular, of the Matisse of Menengrida, the Picasso of Papunya, and so on, the Rubens of Remmingen, and so on. However, a German friend of mine said to me one day, this Ulrich Krempel, who's a major international art curator, and we're having a funny conversation one day, and he remarked that, in fact, Emily was more like what's called the Black Grandma Moses. Now, Grandma Moses is a white person, in fact, who was born in the last century. She was Anne Mary Robinson was her name. She was born in 1860. But she's a really good example. The example came from this, that she was an embroidery maker, a practicing person. That's what she was famous for. She had no training in the arts at all. She started to paint very late in life, in her 80s also, and came to be known as Grandma Moses. She's an example, as I said, of an individual who was successfully beginning a career in the arts at a very advanced age. She began painting in her 70s, not her 80s. That's Emily, who was in her 80s. And she gave up embroidery, in fact, because of arthritis. A New York collector saw one of her paintings and bought it, and she took off also, like Emily. It started to be, she was taken off because it was an inoffensive commodity, in a sense. A very naive landscapes and rural scenes. At one stage, it was said that she was most probably the best known American artist in Europe. Her artwork was used for an advertising campaign with by DuBarry Cosmetics. I'm not a fashion freak, and so I don't understand this, with a lipstick gloss called Primitive Red. Harry Truman, the president of the day, presented her with the Women's National Press Club Trophy Award for outstanding accomplishments in art in 1949. And in 1951, she appeared on the See It Now television program. So she's very famous, a very iconic figure. And I was looking at the Emily photo outside, which is such a weighty, incredible image of Emily, that sideways self-portrait. And you see how much, in fact, we have travelled, in a way, when you think of the stamp, the postage stamp Aboriginal head. What's his name? One pound, Jimmy, yeah. How far we've travelled. We actually do know who the person is. More than that, we'd look stupid if we didn't know who she was. So where I thought about this for a while, and I thought, being the whiz kid, as you know, I'm a great quip with wit, and I used to tell this story until one day I told this story and an independent woman then took me to task about the differences between Emily's work and Grandma Moses. In fact, it's interesting here, I would never think of Emily as a naive artist, and certainly not as a folk artist, which is where Grandma Moses comes out of American folk art tradition. Somehow she jumped the barrier, the canyon, to get into the fine art world. And I had some discussions with Ian and some other people in the last week about the whole inclusion of Aboriginal art into the Australian art scene. It sits there like a cuckoo in the nest, in a positive sense, though, not in a negative sense. No one really, it's really an interesting thing about Australians that we could see the value of Aboriginal art, and we could see it fitting into our society. It's like Aboriginal people have been, in fact, connected to Australian society. There are lots of historical references of Aboriginal people, not only in sport, but in everything we do, as Germaine Greer did allude to in another essay, the influence of Aboriginal society and the influence of Aboriginal practices, social, physical, etc., are things that we've denied as a nation and as a society, taking on board and influencing us as Australian society. And so it's it's most probably the public moment, in a way, where we do acknowledge Aboriginal presence and Aboriginal admiration, the things about Aboriginal life, the things about Aboriginal intellect that we actually admire and should look at more and take on board rather than this Eurocentric view. I've written in a more contemporary essay last year that I did, where I spoke about the fact that Australians waking up the fact that we're not a colony. We're not Europe. Sorry, I went in this way. We're not Europe anymore. We must well, we never were. We're not even a colony of Europe anymore. We're a country existing in Asia and the Pacific. And the quicker we swing around to adopt practices and realise where we are and change the vision, the more comfortable we'll all be, and the more comfortable Aboriginal art will sit into that lexicon in a new way and create a new lexicon of art history that doesn't rely on Western art history to describe it, as Robinson Crusoe did, to name it. It would be stupid to talk about Japanese cultural history and continually use Western terms. The best thing about living in my racist way, counter-racist way, in Japan and being at the Minpaku National Museum of Ethnology, you really knew you're in Japan. Because when you went in, every object for about half the museum was Japanese. The whole history started with Japan. The next room then was Korea, China, Mongolia, and so on. And somewhere way up the back, you came to a little diorama, or diorama, of this with a mannequin in clogs of Europe, this little village with bulls, cows, cattle, etc. And that's as far away as Europe is from Japan, and as far away as it should be intellectually and socially. You should. It's a great thing for a country, for a society, to have that self-confidence. Maybe one day, and most probably not in my lifetime, we'll see that in Australia. Now, I think that's given you enough to think about. It may not quite be on the form and the colours that we're seeing here, but that's really the heart of the art, as it's been said. And I think people shouldn't have too much angst about the form and so on, and even the language that you're using to have this embracement of Aboriginal art. All that's really needed is to read the sign. Instead of describing the sign, it'd be like saying some Martian finding a sign to the gents and trying to talk about it in aesthetic terms. Read the sign. Thank you.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.